Hello, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to another episode of Arab Voices, coming to you from the studios of KPFT Houston since 2002. Houston's community station, 90.1 FM, FM HD1, Galveston 89.5 FM, and Huntsville 91.7 FM. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. This show is syndicated and it airs on dozens of radio stations in different US and European cities. I'd like to begin by thanking each and everyone who donated to KPFT over the past 4 weeks in support of Arab Voices during KPFT's membership drive. Many thanks to Lillian, Dr. Faiza, Anan, Dr. Nasser, Nabil, and others who wanted to remain anonymous. Your contributions made a difference and we greatly appreciate that. Thank you very much. Shukran jazilan. During this episode of Arab Voices, episode number 1170, I will have several segments. First, I will air an opinion by Sumaya Ghannouchi titled A Colonial Reckoning, How Israel's War on Iran Reopens Old Wounds. I will air a couple of interviews Democracy Now! Conducted on the latest Israeli aggression and attack on Iran, interviews with Mohammad Marandi, professor of English literature and Orientalism at the University of Tehran in Iran, who took part in nuclear negotiations in 2015, and with Akbar Shahid Ahmad, senior diplomatic correspondent for Huffington Post. After that, I will air the remarks of Navi Pillay, chair of the United Nations International Independent Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territory, delivered at the United Nations Human Rights Council, on the latest report on the Commission's findings that examined violations of international human rights law, international humanitarian law, and possible international crimes relating to attacks against educational facilities and religious and cultural sites in Gaza. Followed by an interview with Palestinian poet and author Mus'ab Abu Toha and a testimony from a Palestinian in Gaza read at the Gaza Tribunal. While Israel continues its genocide and war crimes on the Palestinians, it started yet another war by attacking and waging an aggression on Iran, as if it has not created enough wars, death, and destructions throughout the Middle East. Israel's lust for wars and destruction of others seems to be endless and on multiple fronts. Sumaya Ghannouchi, a British-Tunisian writer and expert in Middle East politics, recorded the following opinion for Middle East Eye, titled A Colonial Reckoning, How Israel's War on Iran Reopens Old Wounds. Let's take a listen.
Israel isn't hiding its crimes anymore, not in Gaza, not anywhere. It wages open genocide, flattening hospitals, schools, mosques, homes. Over 60,000 people gone. A total siege choked the strip, and through the ruins, people walk for miles, exhausted, starving, just to reach an aid truck. And when they finally do, they're gunned down. Some return with sacks of flour, others with the blooded corpses of loved ones, shot, shelled as they scrambled for a few grains. But Gaza is just one front. In Lebanon, Israel strikes at will. It bombs homes, crosses borders to assassinate, occupies villages it never left. In Syria, it holds the Golan Heights, pushes deeper south, fires missiles to the edge of Damascus. Borders mean nothing, laws mean less. Israel moves how it wants, kills whom it wants, and now it has turned to Iran. After indirect talks in Oman between Tehran and Washington, Israel launched a sudden, unprovoked war. First came the assassinations, generals, scientists, civilian officials, then the bombs, on military bases, power plants, airports, even public infrastructure. The excuse, Iran's nuclear program, peaceful, civilian, fully monitored by the IAEA. The hypocrisy is staggering. Macron raised Israel's defense, calling Iran a threat to global security. This from the same France that helped secretly build Israel's Dimona reactor in the 1950s and 60s, the region's only undeclared nuclear arsenal. No inspections, no accountability. Today, Israel holds 80 to 90 nuclear warheads, maybe more. It has second strike capabilities via submarines and air power. It won't sign the NPT, won't allow inspectors. Yet, it bombs Iran in the name of non-proliferation. Britain swiftly joined in, sent RAF jets to Cyprus, surveillance aircraft, early warning systems, logistical support, all for Israel. The US escalated, deployed the USS Gerald R. Ford, Aegis destroyers, weapons, real-time satellite coordination. The EU sang the same song, Israel has the right to defend itself, even now, when it is the aggressor, when it is Iran defending its sovereignty. The same refrain used to justify the massacre of tens of thousands in Gaza, the same script, the same lie. international law, human rights, moral outrage, all suspended for Israel. The West arms Israel to the teeth, not for safety, but for supremacy, to keep it the region's only nuclear power, to let it dominate, invade, occupy with impunity. Israel was never just a state, it was a Western outpost, a settler colony built as empire collapsed. Britain withdrew its soldiers from the Middle East, but not its ambitions. The US stepped in, took over, and the goal never changed. Control the land, seize the oil, silence the people. But this time, the playbook is failing. Israel is ruled by fanatics, openly, proudly. A state that once cloaked its violence in diplomacy now flaunts it. Ministers threaten annihilation, settlers chant for genocide, soldiers film themselves laughing in the lingerie of the women they've just killed or displaced. In Jerusalem, mobs storm the Al-Aqsa Mosque. They chant, "Muhammad is dead and left girls behind. May your villages burn. There are no schools in Gaza, no kids left. Genocide mainstreamed." And Netanyahu pompously claims to represent the free world, a grotesque parody of truth as he presides over apartheid, occupation, and mass killing. Across the Arab world, millions watch, disgusted, betrayed, bitter, enraged, sick to the soul. Their leaders normalize with war criminals, their people seethe. The region was paralyzed. Until now, because this time, someone stood up. Iran is not the Gaza Strip. It's not 45 square kilometers of open-air prison. It's not an armed group. It's a sovereign nation of 85 million, spanning 1.65 million square kilometers, missiles, mountains, strategic depth. It has absorbed assassinations, cyber attacks, sanctions, and still it stands. Still it strikes back. For the first time since 1948, Israeli cities are burning. The myth of immunity? Gone. And no, Israel cannot play the victim now, not while holding the nukes, not while it's bombing, invading, erasing, and inside Iran, something deeper has stirred, a memory. 1953, the coup against Mossadegh, planned by the CIA, executed with MI6, all because he dared nationalize his country's oil. Operation Ajax toppled a democratically elected government and reinstated the Shah. What followed? 25 years of brutal repression, enforced by the Savak, trained by the West. But the wound goes deeper. 1891, the tobacco revolt, when Britain seized control of Iran's tobacco and Iran said no. Clerics like Ayatollah Shirazi led a national boycott. Even women in royal households joined in, refusing to smoke. The revolt weakened the Qajar dynasty and left a searing truth in Iran's memory. Never bow to foreign control. That memory still lives in every chant, every protest, every funeral, every missile launched today carries a century's weight of betrayal and defiance. And now it's raw again. A clip has gone viral, an Iranian woman, not even wearing the black chador, not your typical regime supporter, her voice breaks with fury. She denounces the genocide in Gaza, the silence of the West, and the decades of humiliation inflicted on her country. Then she shouts, "We want a nuclear bomb." To Iranians, this is about dignity, sovereignty, saying, "We will not be broken again." The shift is regional. Pakistan, the only Muslim country with nuclear weapons, has warned the region is boiling. Pakistan may be next. Israel is allied with India, and Islamabad sees what's coming. Turkey is sounding the alarm. Erdogan's ministers declared Netanyahu has placed us in his sights. A few days ago in the Knesset, Netanyahu declared there will be no Ottoman Empire. This is no history lesson. That is a threat. Israel, drunk on power and Western backing, believes it can bomb, starve, and humiliate the Muslim world into submission. But the region is waking up. This isn't just a war. It's a war on dignity, on the very idea that anyone in this region can stand tall. And yet Western media dreams on. The BBC interviews the Shah's son, inquires if Israeli bombs might liberate Iran, as if Iranians want to be saved by the son of a dictator, by a dictator they overthrew, as if freedom comes from toppled monarchs and Western missiles. Israel thought it could do what it's always done, assassinate, bomb, walk away. But now, Tel Aviv is burning, Haifa is under fire, Ashkelon is not safe. For the first time, the war is on Israeli soil. The myth of invincibility is broken. Iran can endure. It is fast. It is resilient. It has been preparing for this moment for decades. The dream that Israel could destroy Iran's regime with surgical strikes and walk away unscathed has collapsed. Tel Aviv has lit a fire it cannot contain.
That was Sumaya Ghannouchi, a British-Tunisian writer and expert in Middle East politics, with an opinion for Middle East Eye. For more information about the Middle East Eye, visit www.middleeasteye.net. On June 12, 2025, Israel launched a sudden and unprovoked attack on Iran, as if its ongoing genocide and war crimes in Gaza are not enough, and as if its ongoing attacks on Syria and Lebanon are not enough. It wants to continue its path of waging endless wars against Arab and Muslim countries that do not bow for it and do not agree and reject its settler colonial plans. During the June 18, 2025 episode of Democracy Now!, Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez spoke with a couple of experts on the subject matter. They interviewed Mohammed Marandi, professor of English literature and Orientalism at the University of Tehran in Iran, who took part in nuclear negotiations in 2015, and with Akbar Shahid Ahmed, senior diplomatic correspondent for Huffington Post. Let's listen in.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
We begin today's show in Iran. In a televised address, Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei has rejected President Trump's calls for unconditional surrender and warned Iran will meet any U.S. military action in Iran with, quote, irreparable harm. Trump's directly threatened Khamenei by writing on Truth Social that the U.S. knows where he is, adding, quote, we are not going to take him out, at least not for now. This comes as multiple reports indicate Trump is moving closer to ordering U.S. airstrikes on Iran. On Tuesday, he dismissed findings on Iran by his own intelligence agencies. In March, the director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, told lawmakers the intelligence community, quote, continues to assess that Iran is not building a nuclear weapon, unquote. On Tuesday, Trump dismissed Gabbard's testimony when asked about it by reporters.
Tulsi Gabbard testified in March that the intelligence community said Iran wasn't building a nuclear weapon.
I don't care what she said. I think they were very close to having one.
This all comes as Israel's continuing to attack Iran for a sixth day, forcing thousands of people to flee Tehran. More than 50 Israeli warplanes struck targets inside Iran in the early hours of today. Iran responded by firing ballistic missiles and launching drones at Israel. According to one count, Israeli strikes since Friday have killed at least 585 people across Iran and wounded over 1,300 others. Iranian strikes on Israel have killed at least 23 people and injured over 630. On Capitol Hill, Democratic Senator Tim Kaine called for his colleagues to support his war powers resolution to prevent a U.S. war with Iran.
I happen to believe that the United States engaging in a war against Iran, a third war in the Middle East since 2001, would be a catastrophic blunder for this country.
Meanwhile, there's a growing split within Trump's MAGA coalition over the prospect of the U.S. attacking Iran. Conservative TV host Tucker Carlson has railed against what he's called warmongers within the Republican Party. On Tuesday, video went viral of him interviewing the hawkish Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz.
If you don't know anything about the country—
I didn't say I don't know anything about—
Okay, what's the ethnic mix of Iran?
They are Persians and predominantly Shia. Okay,
You don't know anything about Iran.
I am not the Tucker Carlson expert on Iran.
You're a senator who's calling for the overthrow of the government. You don't know anything about the country.
For more, we're joined by two guests. In Washington, D.C., Akbar Shahid Ahmed is the senior diplomatic correspondent for HuffPost, where his latest pieces are headlined, Israel's War on Iran Bears the Echo of Past American Mistakes. And another article, the pro-Israel U.S. general quietly influencing Trump on Iran. But we begin in Tehran with Mohammed Marandi, professor of English literature and Orientalism at the University of Tehran, part of the nuclear deal negotiations in 2015. We welcome you both back to Democracy Now! Mohammed Marandi, let's begin with you. You're in the capital of Iran, in Tehran, the capital that where President Trump has said everyone should leave. Can you talk about what's happening? Describe the scene on the ground. How are people dealing?
Well, the administration here has facilitated people leaving Tehran since a few days ago. Many government agencies are now allowing people to work from home or to take vacation. And university and school exams have been canceled for now so that those who want to leave city can do so. So Trump's warning, which is an act of terror, really didn't have a huge impact. Many people had already left. People like myself are here in Tehran. Actually, I'm in the Iranian National Television and Radio buildings, in one of the buildings that's been evacuated. I'm here because the internet is a bit better, is better than outside. And as you know, the day before yesterday, they bombed the Iranian radio and television network and murdered a number of journalists.
And Professor, we have all these reports of the targeted killings or assassinations of key leaders and scientists in Iran. To what degree do you feel that this terror campaign of Israel has destabilized Iran's top leadership?
Actually, these terror attacks have united the country more than ever before, or at least since, in my opinion, when Saddam Hussein invaded Iran. Those assassinations were carried out during the first hours of this unprovoked attack, and they bombed apartment blocks to get people. They, for example, in one apartment block where they were seeking to murder one or two high-ranking military officials, they killed everyone, 65 people, including over 20 children. So that was not, and Western media tries to celebrate this and to show how sophisticated such an attack is. It's not sophisticated. My neighbors know where I am. Their neighbors know they live there. There's nothing sophisticated about slaughtering everyone in a building, in an apartment building, to murder one or two people. But that's, of course, what the Israeli regime has done across the board. They destroy apartment blocks in Beirut. And, of course, Western media would call these Hezbollah targets in order to hide the crimes. And we've seen what they've been doing in Gaza for 21 months, this genocide, this Holocaust, where they're slaughtering everyone everywhere. So we shouldn't have any expectations for the Israeli regime to behave any different towards Iranians, because for them, we are all Amalek.
And also, I noticed that in the last day or so, the Iranian government has urged its people to delete social media platforms like WhatsApp and Instagram. The government claims that these platforms are relaying information to Israel, geolocation information about individual Iranians. This prospect of these media companies or actually participating or colluding with Israel. What's your sense of that?
Yes, Meta is actively participating in the attacks on Iran. They are giving locations for academics, university professors. I, too, unfortunately, have WhatsApp. I do not have Instagram. My account was deleted by Instagram a long time ago. But I only have WhatsApp because many journalists are trying to contact me, and I don't have any other means but to stay in contact with some of these people. And of course, people have asked me to give up my cell phone, but again, I have no option, because if I do, then I cannot conduct interviews. So I have to take this risk. But others are being encouraged to delete Instagram and to delete WhatsApp, and I encourage people across the world to do so as well.
I wanted to get your response, Mohammad Mirandi, to first the Iran Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei rejecting Trump's calls for unconditional surrender, warning that Iran will meet any U.S. military action in Iran with irreparable harm, the significance of him speaking out, and of Trump directly threatening him. We followed this over a few days. Trump has gone back and forth, you know, U.S. officials saying that he stopped Netanyahu from targeting Ali Khamenei, but then threatening Ali Khamenei himself, and ultimately, most recently writing, we are not going to take him out, at least not for now. Can you talk about the significance of all of this and the U.S. Fleet moving closer to the Middle East and Trump now apparently moving closer to getting directly involved, the whole issue of whether the U.S. would use something that they haven't yet given to Israel, which is a bunker buster bomb in Forta?
Well, Trump and Netanyahu are two sides of the same coin. They're both genocidal. and they have no red lines. And the Iranians, of course, will ignore their threats and continue to defend the country's sovereignty against this unprovoked aggression and this war that's been imposed upon us. The Iranians have said very clearly that if the United States attacks, Iran will punish it severely. And Iran's underground drone and missile bases across the Persian Gulf region and the Indian Ocean are prepared for war. And I think those tiny Arab dictatorships in the Persian Gulf that have oil and gas installations, those that host American bases, and all of them do, if there is war, these regimes will be swept away because those bases are on their territory, and ordinary Iranians believe that they are fully complicit in any aggression against Iran. So in case of any act of war against Iran by the United States, I think that will be catastrophic for the global economy. It will bring about a great depression, worse than the 1930s in the United States.
Yeah, I'd like to bring in Akbar Shahid Ahmed, senior diplomatic correspondent for HuffPost. Akbar, your reaction to the events of the last couple of days in this Israeli attack on Iran?
I think while we're seeing a really tremendous risk, as Dr. Mirandi is saying, of the U.S. being pulled in, and we have to remember that in addition to, you know, the bases, the U.S. partners, United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Bahrain, which are all major energy exporters, maybe not to the U.S., but to the global economy, to Europe, to China, to Asia. Beyond that, there are 40,000 U.S. troops, right? Many of them in Iraq, many across the region. Donald Trump, while saying that he was a peace through strength, anti-war president, we haven't seen him solve any of the wars that he said he would address, Ukraine, Gaza. In fact, now there's a new war unfolding on his watch, and he hasn't brought back any of these military deployments. What this tells us, really, is that because he's kind of crippled the federal government, he's undermined the State Department, there's chaos at the top ranks of the Pentagon, there isn't even capacity in the Trump administration to de-escalate at this point. And B, Trump didn't really have a clear strategic doctrine, right? For Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, the goal of an attack on Iran, and frankly, a joint U.S.-Israeli attack on Iran, that's been a long-standing goal. He's wanted that for decades. Netanyahu, through the Biden administration, before Trump entered office, was able to amass more and more American support. And I think he looked at this and said, this is my moment. Trump can't stop me. I've had a clear goal. And so I think that's where we're at a moment of immense danger. The only kind of restraining, de-escalatory force could really be the U.S. You have regional governments, Saudi Arabia among them, the Qataris, Oman, which has hosted talks between the U.S. and Iran. All these regional governments are trying to de-escalate. But what I hear from Arab diplomats is, while the Trump administration is issuing statements to them, even behind the scenes, saying, no, don't worry, we're not going to get the U.S. involved, there's a clear gap between that rhetoric, which matches Trump's, again, peace through strength, anti-war claims, and Trump's actual actions, which are indicating a very clear U.S. military buildup and an increasing likelihood of a hugely devastating U.S. war with Iran.
Akbar, if you can talk about this latest piece, Israel's war on Iran, the latest piece that you wrote, on who is got Trump's ear?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Amy, it's really interesting, right? This is a team where the president has made personal fealty, personal loyalty, the main qualifying factor, right? You've seen him reject intelligence, saying that Iran was not rushing towards a nuclear weapon. You've seen him devastate the State Department. You've seen him fire top military commanders, which means that the people around him are either really cowed or very weak or thinking about their own careers. Into that gap, the person that steps in and who I highlighted in this recent piece is someone called Eric Kurilla. That's the top U.S. military commander in the Middle East. He's a four-star army general. He's been in his position since 2022. And what was striking as I got to understand Kurilla's deep influence over Trump was a couple of things. He's, even by the standards of American officials who work really closely with Israeli counterparts all the time, Kurilla is seen as extremely close. One former U.S. official told me, in internal deliberations, Guerrilla often seemed to know what the Israelis were thinking and what intelligence they had before any other person in the American government. So there's that level of familiarity. He was in position under Biden, which was a period during which he worked really closely with the Israelis in the wars in Gaza, in Lebanon, and in Israel's defense, right, against Iranian barrages, which it did face in 2024. In that period, he began kind of joint planning with the Israelis for a U.S.-Israeli strike, and now it looks like the moment is ripe. And there's another just confluence of factors that increase the danger here. Guerrilla is looking at his retirement date in the coming months, maybe even as soon as July. And the chatter among American and Israeli officials for a while has been, we want to get this joint U.S.-Israeli campaign against Iran done while Guerrilla is in office. So all these factors have come together. And we have to remember that's happening under, again, a President Donald Trump, who, as one expert told me, looks at stars and badges, and he can't say no, right? He hero worships the military. He sees it as a kind of expression of masculinity, of strength, of all these dynamics he's obsessed with. So is Donald Trump really going to tell a general, even one who, you know, necessarily, Guerrilla is not necessarily, Tucker Carlson's talked about warmongers. I think Guerrilla and other military leaders would say we're very much thinking about the U.S.'s best interests, but military leaders are battlefield leaders. They are not necessarily strategists for long-term stability, nor are they politicians who can win public support. When the American public has shown they are very war-wary, and when it's not clear how a U.S.-Israeli strike would lead to a better strategic long-term picture instead of unpredictable chaos and violence, do we really want a military leader to be the most influential voice in Trump's ear? That's where we are right now with General Guerrilla.
And Akbar, I wanted to ask you, the Israeli government has got, the officials have kept claiming that they're not interested in regime change in Iran. But yet this week, the Jerusalem Post has an article about the eldest son of the late Shah of Iran, Reza Pahlavi, talking about how he has a 100-day transition plan and that he will soon be back in Iran. Your thoughts on how the impact of this kind of news on the Iranian people?
It's impossible to separate headlines like that from the last 22 years of U.S. foreign policy in the region, right? People hear that and they think about regime change in Iraq, which led to chaos and the rise of ISIS. They hear that, they think about Libya, which again, chaotic, horrible human trafficking situation. So I think the way that this is resonating for Iranians, I imagine, and also certainly for Americans and audiences around the world is, this is just so fantastical, right? And Israeli officials, to your point, have said two things at once. They have said, we're not pursuing regime change. Our goal is to limit Iran's nuclear development. But we've also seen Israeli officials across the board, importantly, not just Netanyahu, but the leading opposition figures, political rivals of Netanyahu, really senior Israeli political figures have come out and said, you know, we're not necessarily doing regime change, but Iranian people, don't you think this is a great time to have a revolution? You know, and I think that kind of, there's a lot in there that's concerning, right? I think for Iranian activists who have been raising their voices and been really viciously repressed for it, they feel that their message, their calls for reform are being hijacked in a way by Netanyahu, who is deeply unpopular there. And I just think it's very unlikely to work, right? There's not there's not an indication throughout history, and certainly not in recent Middle Eastern history, that suggests local communities under bombing are going to say, absolutely, the people bombing us are the liberators. This is who we want to stand with. With regard to Reza Pahlavi and this idea of restoring the monarchy in Iran, Pahlavi lives here in D.C. He's very much a fixture in kind of hawkish circles, close to people here. But the kind of magical thinking that you're seeing among D.C. policymakers, where they believe that someone who's been out of Iran since 1979 is going to go in and understand the modern country where most people are young, where most people have not ever lived under Shah, it's just remarkable and stunning, right? And you mentioned earlier in the show these congressional efforts that Senator Kaine is leading, some legislators in the House are leading. And I do think there's a significant number of Democrats who are willing to stand up and question whether another clear attempt at regime change or certainly a risk of mission creep is worth it. But you aren't seeing Republicans sign on. Only one Republican member of Congress so far has joined those resolutions. And that tells us a lot about the disconnect between the really, again, magical thinking, hawkish thinking in decision-making and policy circles here in Washington and people in America, people in Iran, people around the world.
Akbar Ashahed Ahmed, we want to thank you for being with us, senior diplomatic correspondent for HuffPost. His recent pieces will link to at democracynow.org. Israel's war in Iran bears the echo of past American mistakes, and the pro-Israel U.S. general quietly influencing Trump on Iran. Speaking to us from D.C., Mohammed Brandi, thank you as well, professor of English literature and Orientalism at the University of Tehran, part of the nuclear deal negotiations of 2015.
That was an interview Democracy Now! Conducted with Mohammed Marandi, professor of English literature and Orientalism at the University of Tehran in Iran, who took part in nuclear negotiations in 2015, and with Akbar Shahid Ahmed, senior diplomatic correspondent for Huffington Post. You're listening to Arab Voices, originating on KPFT Houston since 2002 and syndicated on other radio stations in different U.S. and European cities. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Israel's catastrophic war crimes, genocide, and ethnic cleansing in the destroyed and occupied Gaza Strip continue despite the world's attention shifting to the Israeli aggression on Iran. Not that the world was paying that much attention to Israel's genocide in Gaza anyway. Israel has been enjoying and continues to enjoy complete, full impunity for all the atrocities, war crimes, genocide, and ethnic cleansing it has been committing and continues to commit against the Palestinians. On June 17, 2025, Navi Pillay, chair of the United Nations International Independent Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territory, presented at the UN Human Rights Council on the findings of a new report that examined violations of international human rights law, international humanitarian law, and possible international crimes relating to attacks against educational facilities and religious and cultural sites in Gaza. Let's listen to her remarks.
I speak before this council 20 months into the most ruthless, prolonged, and widespread attack against the Palestinian people since 1948. The goal of the Israeli government is abundantly clear: the destruction of life in Gaza. For a year and a half now, our commission has been investigating the violence in Gaza. We have seen constant escalation and more deaths and injuries. The violence has extended now into southern Lebanon, then Yemen, and now Iran. We have said in relation to violence in Palestine and Israel that security can only come with peace. We say that again now in relation to this new regional conflict involving Israel and Iran. Peace, justice, and respect for human rights are the only ways forward in which the peoples of the region can live in security. We should not let this regional escalation divert our attention from the ongoing carnage in Gaza, where hundreds continue to be killed each week. In the last 3 months, the entire population of Gaza was forcibly transferred into small enclaves, and Palestinians were killed while attempting to receive aid, bringing life to its bleakest point to date. Children have paid an unimaginable price. More than 1,300 children have been killed just from the end of the ceasefire on 18th March to date, and more than 15,000 children have been identified as having been killed since October 2023. These are not just intolerable numbers. Each child killed represents a past, a present, and a future that will no longer exist. Excellencies, the report before you today examines attacks on educational, religious, and cultural sites in the occupied Palestinian territory and in Israel. Our findings show that as Israeli security forces killed thousands of children, they also obliterated the education system in Gaza. More than 90% of schools and university buildings in Gaza have been damaged or destroyed, creating conditions where education for children has been made impossible. With the loss of education, Palestinians are also losing their source of stability, of hope, and of a possibility for the future. Israeli airstrikes have targeted educational facilities believed to be safe refuge, areas, killing the displaced, including children and women, and deliberately shelled, burned, and demolished schools and universities. The commission could not identify any military necessity which justifies such actions, and we conclude that these actions show an intent to destroy these facilities in order to curtail Palestinians' access to education in the long term. These attacks were part of a widespread and relentless assault against the Palestinian people, in which Israeli forces have committed war crimes, including directing attacks against civilians and willful killing, and the crime against humanity of extermination. Excellencies, the systematic targeting of educational facilities has extended well beyond Gaza and has impacted all Palestinian children in the occupied Palestinian territory. In the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem, closures, demolition orders, restrictions, military raids, and large-scale military operations have resulted in a significant loss of school days. Settlers have been responsible for violent attacks against schools and against students, leaving children and educators terrified and traumatized. Israeli authorities often directly incite such attacks or do not protect Palestinians, promoting a regime of impunity for violent settlers. Excellencies, attacks by Israeli security forces have damaged more than half of all religious and cultural sites in the Gaza Strip, part of a wider campaign to destroy civilian targets and civilian infrastructure through airstrikes and shelling. Israeli attacks also targeted religious sites that served as places of refuge, killing hundreds of people, including women and children. Such damage was completely avoidable, given that Israeli security forces knew or should have known the locations and the significance of Gaza's prominent cultural sites and should have planned all military operations accordingly. The damage to religious and historical buildings, monuments, and other tangible heritage has a cascading effect and deeply affects intangible cultural elements, such as religious and cultural practices, memories, and history, undermining the identity of Palestinians as a people. In the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem, the Commission found that Israeli authorities have appropriated, developed, and profited from cultural heritage sites representing Palestinian, Jewish, and other cultures, and have suppressed non-Jewish heritage. They displaced Palestinian residents from those sites, blocked or severely restricted Palestinians from accessing such sites, and conducted archaeological excavations leading to the creation of tourist attractions, which is unlawful under international law. Such actions deny the relationship of Palestinians to the land's heritage and history. Israel has been using cultural heritage and settlements as leverage for its unlawful territorial claims in the occupied West Bank, in flagrant defiance of multiple United Nations resolutions and the 2024 advisory opinion of the International Court of Justice. Excellencies, we have repeatedly requested the Israeli authorities to grant us immediate, unimpeded access to the occupied Palestinian territory, including Gaza, in accordance with our mandate and the order of the International Court of Justice of 24th May, 2024. Israel has ignored all of these requests. The Commission reiterates its call for a complete and unconditional cessation of hostilities. We demand an immediate and full end to the siege imposed on Gaza and the release of all those arbitrarily detained, including all hostages, both Israeli and Palestinian. Attacks against educational, religious, and cultural sites must stop immediately. All parties must ensure the protection, preservation, and development of cultural heritage sites representing Jewish and Palestinian cultures alike. Excellencies, we have emphasized on several occasions that atrocities committed by one side do not justify those committed by the other in reaction. All those who have committed atrocities must be brought to justice and held fully accountable. We have also noted that the October 7th attacks against Israel and Israel's subsequent attacks on Gaza were preceded by decades of violence and retribution, dispossession, unlawful occupation, and denial of the Palestinians' right to self-determination. The extensive physical destruction of Gaza, the dismantling of its educational and healthcare systems, the destruction of housing and infrastructure, and the targeting and destruction of heritage sites, including limiting of access to those sites and the erasure of their heterogenic history, are intended to erode Palestinians' historical ties to the land and weaken their collective identity, thereby hindering their right to self-determination. In line with the advisory opinion of the International Court of Justice, the Commission emphasizes that all member states, individually and collectively, and the United Nations, are under a legal obligation to work cooperatively to bring to an end the unlawful occupation and ensure the Palestinians' right to self-determination. The Commission strongly supports the resolution adopted by the General Assembly last week, condemning the use of starvation as a weapon of war, demanding a full lifting of the Israeli blockade on humanitarian aid, and insisting on the protection of civilians under international law. It is incumbent on all states to act resolutely to end the slaughter and stop the atrocities.
That was Navi Pillay, chair of the United Nations International Independent Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territory. I have a link to the full report Pillay was talking about posted on our website, arabvoices.net. Mus'ab Abu Toha, Palestinian author and poet, was interviewed on Democracy Now! On June 18, 2025, on the catastrophic situation in Gaza. Let's take a listen.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to Gaza, where the death toll from an Israeli attack on aid seekers in Khan Yunis Tuesday has reached 70. Hundreds of Palestinians were also wounded. Israeli forces attacked using tanks, drones, machine guns on crowds gathered hoping to receive bags of flour. A spokesperson for the Gaza Civil Defense said, quote, Israeli drones fired at the citizens. Some minutes later, Israeli tanks fired several shells at the citizens, which led to a large number of martyrs and wounded, unquote. This is Dr. Mark Brunner, a doctor from Oregon who's volunteering at the Nasser Hospital.
Every time we know that there's a few so-called food distribution, we know that there's going to be annihilation. And, you know, the first couple of days, we were seeing a lot of isolated injuries, head or chest or abdomen. But today, it's reported that tanks have been used at the food distribution centers, which makes sense because we're seeing multi-trauma. We're seeing head, neck, chest, abdomen, extremities, many, many deaths. And it just doesn't have to be this way. You know, this is something that's just got to stop.
This comes as a group of UN experts in Geneva told the UN Human Rights Council Israel's committing war crimes and the crime against humanity of extermination. For more, we're joined by the Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, the Palestinian author Mus'ab Abu Toha. His latest piece is headlined, What Gaza Needs Now, in the New Yorker magazine. Mus'ab joins us from Syracuse, New York, where he has moved from Gaza with his family. Mus'ab, welcome back to Democracy Now! Your latest piece is devastating. You write, my family is starving, my neighbors are dying. I'm compelled to share these injustices because they need to stop. Tell us about your constant conversations with people in Gaza, some soon after die, and what you're calling for now.
Thank you so much, Amy, for having me again. Thank you so much, Democracy Now!, for amplifying the stories that do not, unfortunately, get to be heard by mainstream media. As I said in my piece, the aim of writing these stories and sharing them with the outside world, because, you know, there was a full internet blackout for the past few days. It was fixed, and now it's again, it's not working. So the hope of sharing the news and sharing stories is that these stories will not happen again and again. And just a few hours after I published the piece, there was another massacre of aid seekers, whether in North Gaza or in the middle of the Gaza Strip or in Rafah. If we're going to talk about, you know, the trouble of or the risk of going to get aid, yesterday there was a massacre, a huge massacre on the Rashid Street on the beach of Gaza City. More than 60 people were killed while trying to get aid from the trucks that were entering from Israel. That these 60s were just part of the 100 people who were killed only yesterday. This morning, I want to tell you what happened today, local time in Gaza, after 3 a.m. Now in Gaza, it is at 4 or 3 a.m. So since 3 a.m., Israel bombed a tent in Khan Yunis at 3 a.m. Five people were killed. Three of them were from one same family, a father and his two children. And then there were early reports that Israel was targeting Palestinians who were seeking aid near the Netzarim distribution. They call it distribution site. 11 people were killed. These are confirmed people who were killed, and 70 people were wounded. And then there was an airstrike on a tent in Khan Yunis, in Mawasi Khan Yunis, so-called humanitarian zone or non-combat zone. Six people were killed. And then there was another airstrike, and this is devastating. We just got the names. There was an airstrike on a house in Al Zaytun neighborhood in Gaza City. Eight people were killed. Of them, there were seven children. And I just posted their names, if you allow me to read the names of these kids. Their names are Zayd, Bisan, Muhammad, Asil, Sama, Lama, Saad. So these are seven kids from Mansour family who were killed today morning at 3 a.m. local time. And then as we're talking, there are reports that three people were killed near the aid site in Rafah. And just an hour ago, three people were killed near the Ahli Baptist Hospital in Gaza City, close to the Shurafa roundabout. So I just read to you the news of what has been happening in Gaza in the past, less than 12 hours, in the past 12 hours. So people continue to starve, and there are lots of lying that I hear on the news that Israel distributed, or this so-called humanitarian foundation, distributed 13 million meals. These are big lies. What meals? I mean, my family in Gaza, they have never received any meal. My wife's family never received any meals. I don't know where they bring these numbers. I don't know how they come up with these numbers, but these are not true at all. People have to go to the so-called distribution site, and they know they will be killed. And many people, when I post the videos or news of people getting killed while trying to get aid, they tell me, Mus'ab, tell them not to go. It's like, you know what? It's like, you know, when COVID hit and people knew that there is a dangerous virus, and as if you're asking, no, don't go out, don't go to buy things, don't go shopping, don't go visit, don't go to the hospital because there is COVID outside. People will not stop going out to get food for themselves and for their children, even though they know, first, they will be killed, and they know that they will not necessarily get fooded because it's very, very small amount of food that is getting in.
Mossab, I wanted to ask you also the fear that among Palestinians that now that Israel has launched this war on Iran, that the rest of the world will shift its focus and forget about what is happening in Gaza, and that some people believe that this is precisely part of the plan of Netanyahu because Israel has been so discredited internationally by its attacks in Gaza. Your sense, are the Palestinians being forgotten at this moment?
You know what? I mean, first of all, people thought that, unfortunately, when Israel attacked Iran during the night, people thought that in some way that the focus of the Israeli airstrikes would be less because they are going to move their troops or move their F-16, their death warplanes somewhere else. Although we don't wish anyone else in the world to be killed. Right. So people thought that this would result in less pressure, less death in Gaza. But this is not what we have seen. Unfortunately, this is not a war in Gaza. It's a genocide that is happening while Israel is targeting everything. People seeking aid, people who are trying to get to the hospital, and people who do not find medicine to heal, do not have healthy food to heal. So people thought that this in some way would change the focus of this Israeli genocide somewhere else without necessarily resulting in the death of so many people in other places. But what we are watching right now is that Israel intensified its airstrikes. Yesterday, they killed about more than 100 people, 60 of them, as I mentioned, while seeking aid in Beit Lahia, in Rafah, in Nusayrat, middle of Gaza. And today morning, just in the past 12 hours, Israel killed more than 40 people. So it's not like people in Gaza want people to move its killing machine somewhere else. But Israel is not letting anyone survive. Not in Gaza, not in Iran, not in Syria, not in Lebanon. They continue to kill in so many places, and they say, "Oh, we are attacked by so many people, and everyone wants us to disappear from the map." As if they are not disappearing, us Palestinians in Gaza. If you look at the what they call evacuation orders or evacuation warnings, yesterday. 5 days ago, they posted a general photo map of Gaza, and they marked the areas that are called combat zones in red. And it was about 70% of the Gaza Strip. One day after that, they added one more square of red into the map. So they expanded their so-called combat zone. Yesterday, they added more red areas, which means that this area should be evacuated. And so this Israel is expanding their combat zone, which is in one way or another, they are occupying this area militarily. And the more dangerous thing is not that they are marking these areas as combat zones. They are telling everyone, and this is in Arabic, they say, returning to this area would put your life at risk. So they are telling people that, okay, we are gonna tell you that this area is combat zone, and you are not allowed to return to it. They don't tell you that, okay, this is a combat zone for a month, for a week, for 2 weeks, or for a year. No, it is indefinitely a combat zone. If you go back there and we ask them, oh, why did you kill this guy? They say, oh, he returned to a combat zone. Even though this guy or that family returned not to live because there's
Masav,
no life
there. We have 30 seconds.
They just wanted to return to find something that they left because they couldn't carry everything, whether it's clothes, whether it's shoes, whether it's... I don't know. This is devastating. Israel is committing these war crimes live, and we are posting about them. We are publishing the names of these children who are killed, and no one cares.
Masav Abu Toha, Pulitzer Prize-winning Palestinian poet and author, will link to your piece in The Yorker, What Gaza Needs Now. My family is starving. My neighbors are dying. I'm compelled to share these injustices because they need to stop.
That was an interview Democracy Now! Conducted with Palestinian poet and author Masav Abu Toha. During the previous episodes of Arab Voices, I talked about and aired some of the remarks and testimonies delivered at the historic Gaza Tribunal held in Sarajevo in May 2025. I'm going to share with you now another Gaza testimony read at the tribunal by Professor Susan Akram, a clinical professor and director of the International Human Rights Clinic at Boston University School of Law, and co-chair of the International Law Chamber at the Gaza Tribunal. Let's listen in.
So our last testimony is from Shireen Mustafa Abdul Qadir Safi, 40 years old, southern Gaza Strip. I was living in a 190-meter apartment in a family building consisting of three layers. At 6:30 on Saturday morning, we heard the sounds of explosions and missiles. They were violent and frightening explosions. No one could go to school, and my husband could not go to his work. Then, on the 13th, at about 11 o'clock in the morning, we heard the news of the martyrdom and burial of members of my husband's family in the Tal al-Zatar area. We heard the news of the martyrdom and burial of his family and a house for the Safi family that had been targeted there, where more than 30 people were martyred as a result. And when my husband returned home, he told me that he saw death with his own eyes in the Tal al-Zatar area. He said, "I saw the remains of the martyred people under the rubble, and at 5 o'clock in the evening of the same day, while my husband was standing in front of the house, he was immediately martyred and became scattered parts. He was recognized by my daughter, Asil, who recognized him through the rest of the clothes that he was wearing. While we were going down the street, another missile fell near us, so we left. We left my husband and fled and left him in the street in pieces. My brother Shadi Safi, 35 years old, and my father-in-law Ali Safi, 60 years old, returned to the place where we left my husband in the street. His name is Muhammad Ali Abdul Qadir Safi, 40 years old. They returned to retrieve him and took him to Kamal Adwan Hospital in northern Gaza and buried him in Beit Lahia Cemetery the next day. After that, we were displaced to Osama bin Zayed School in the Safatawi area in northern Gaza. And we stayed there for 2 days in difficult conditions. My brother Shadi came and took us to his house in the Safatawi area, and we stayed a week with him. Difficult conditions. We went then to the Rafidain School in the Jabali al-Balad area, which was very crowded due to the large number of displaced people. And as a result of the shelling and the very difficult living conditions, we decided to leave. And at around 11 o'clock on November 9, we went out on foot because there were no cars towards the Dole roundabout. We all went out, accompanied by my parents and my husband's parents, and when we reached Nusirat, we dispersed. I went to my husband's sister, Manar Safi, in Khan Yunis, and stayed with her for about 2 months. And then on January 16th, we went to the UNRWA Qadila School at 10 p.m. We couldn't carry any blankets, mattresses, or anything. So we headed to Al-Aqsa University, west of Khan Yunis. There was a checkpoint for the occupation army. The army was cursing us. They ordered us to enter, and we were 5 people. But there were thousands of displaced people at the checkpoint. And when we crossed the checkpoint, the occupation army arrested my father-in-law, Ali Abdul Qadir Ali Safi. He was released after 22 days. We headed to Rafah, to the Talasutal neighborhood, to a tent inside one of the lands, which consisted of a few pieces of wood and nylon. We made a primitive tent without any breadwinner, and the beginning of the 5th month, we were displaced at El Atar and stayed 2 months inside a tent. The conditions were difficult. And then we went to the Al-Baraka camp for orphans.
That was the voice of Professor Susan Akram reading one of the Gaza testimonies at the Gaza Tribunal held in Sarajevo in May 2025. You've been listening to Arab Voices, originating on KPFT Houston since 2002 and syndicated on other radio stations in different cities in the US and Europe. Our shows are archived online and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.